is April 26th, 2000. This is Eleanor Wax, folklorist, interviewing Charles Mangus on Nantucket Island. Charles is a skrimshander.
Okay, so here we are. And why don't you tell me a little bit again, so we have it on tape, how you got started. You said you've been doing this for 30 years or so.
I was living on the Cape, and I was fortunate enough to have a neighbor, a gentleman named John Mitchell, who was in his 80s, who restored antique furniture and worked for a lot of the old dealers on the Cape, the old-timers. He was about 82 when I went to work for him, and I used to cut his grass. So one day he called me in, and he said, "Can you help me hold something?" And I had been in his shop, and it had every conceivable handmade jig, tools that were as old as he was. I mean, he must have gotten them, you know, from someone else along the line. He was a nice, nice man, and so shaky hands and bad eyesight. And the next day, I was working with him every day from then on. He got someone else to cut his grass, you know. And I was intrigued, and we hit it off. I mean, it was the strangest sort of relationship, a 15-year-old kid, you know, an 80-plus-year-old man. But we just, we worked together really well in the shop. This was in 1970. And I spent the rest of the time working with him in the shop. And we worked on incredible things, antique furniture, ship models, you name it. And as his eyes got worse, his mind was sharp, but his eyes got worse and worse and worse. I started taking on, and he taught me a lot of, you know, traditional things, but the scrimshaw had always intrigued me. My mother had gotten me a book, The Story of Yankee Whaling, when I was like 8 or 9 years old, and I read it and read it and read it. And growing up where we grew up, you know, I was the stuff was there.
Did you grow up on Nantucket?
I don't know. Actually, I grew up between the North Shore and Cape Cod.
Where? So you grew up between the North Shore and Cape Cod.
Right. And like I said, I eventually landed back home on the Cape and worked for John for, gosh, almost going on 3 years.
What town on the Cape was this?
In Yarmouth. Yeah, and he introduced me to some of the people that he did work for, some of the dealers, and I saw some of their scrimshaw collections and collectors, and then I got the bug. And so what happened was he had a couple of whale's teeth, like I said, kicking around in the shop, and one day I said to him, "John, instead of giving me," and he used to pay me every day, it was kind of funny, he just had this thing, he'd give me my pay every day instead of at the end of the week. And I said, instead of my daily pay, I said, "Would you give me those whale's teeth? They weren't really worth all that much back then." And he said, "Oh, just take them, you know." And then he gave me my pay, and it was that kind of relationship, you know.
Nice.
I mean, it was to the point where he didn't have children, and I think in a lot of respects, I, you know, it was a surrogate son to him, and I really enjoyed spending time with him and his wife too. In fact, when he died, his wife gave me a lot of the tools, which I have here in the shop, that old bandsaw and some of the other things here, that old Colombian vise, and some of the a lot of the hand tools that he had even made himself. So I took the teeth home and sanded them down, and there was no primers, there was nothing. So my earliest works really were going to the museums, looking at antique pieces done by sailors, and that's how I kind of, you know, the work
you were
really
sort of self-taught.
Yeah, there weren't any primers, there weren't any how-tos. I mean, John had carved a couple of things for fun. In fact, I tried to buy one of his pieces at auction several years ago that he had done, and I unfortunately
what was his last name?
Mitchell. Yeah, and he was just a wonderful inspiration for me. You know, and he was the man that really got me. He made the he introduced me to people. He made the contacts. And those are things, I mean, that I couldn't have done myself.
That's really fortunate.
You know? Yeah. So I'll always be indebted to him for getting me started and getting me hooked, not only with my art, but also with antiques.
At what point did you, venture off on your own?
Well, I went off to college, and I found that that's when I was telling you about doing shows and things like that.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to Mass College of Art in Boston.
Oh, yeah.
They didn't understand what I was doing. I mean, this is back in the early 70s, and everybody was kind of throwing paint on canvases, and I had a real traditional art form. So I walked in, and no one understood it because there was no history. I mean, I found one grad student that that understood what I was doing.
It wasn't the place, you know.
It wasn't, and there was the Save the Whales stuff at that particular point, too, which I had to try to explain to people that these are 200-year-old whale's teeth, you know? And so I just got very defensive, and I said, this is not the place for me to show my work. It's the place for me to study. But I continued to do my artwork, and I continued to sell my artwork, albeit sort of, you know.
When you say artwork, do you mean?
My scrimshaw.
Your scrimshaw.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because even at that particular point, I started to have, there was a lot of interest, you know, back in the early 70s. Kennedy's collection had kind of come into the fold, and it was then, you know, when they built the JFK Library, it was all on display. And, but again, my work was very, it was really influenced by the earliest artists and artisans, in the whalemen. So it wasn't until I kind of got out and got my own style and took the drawing skills that I learned at school. But I'm still very traditional in the way I do my things. There are people who do different things.
When you say you're very traditional in what regard? In the way that you work, in the things that you carve, in both? I mean,
God, that's a good question. I'll give you an example right here. This is a basket that I made with an artist who does beautiful basket work. Her name is Martha Lawrence, and I made this for my daughter when she was just a couple of years old. It's got baleen collar stays, which are very unusual. The baleen collar stays would have been used in the, well, I've got a collar stay right here in this shirt.
Mm-hmm.
And I found a bundle of these, and I said to Martha, look, I want to make a basket I want you to make a basket for my daughter that's like no other, because she's not like no other. So what I did was I went to New Bedford and studied a lot of the antique pie crimpers and carved this pie crimper. It's a exact reproduction of the one in the collection. And the wheel spins, as you can see. It's a laminate of whalebone and ebony. So it was all this stuff on the inside. There's her her initials, and they're inlaid in mother of pearl abalone shell. I don't know if the light's going to be good enough for you here.
I don't have
flash. Okay. But this is really the tradition. This is, as I was telling you, this is where I draw a lot of my inspiration from.
It's
is
beautiful.
The classic forms, you know.
Beautiful.
Well, thank you.
Very beautiful.
I turned the all the knobs and pegs myself in whalebone. This is whalebone here, but I wanted to do something different, so I used ebony on the inside. So it's a laminate.
Yeah, beautiful.
And then I used the ivory for the field, and then I inlaid her initials in the top, and even used the abalone shell on the ends and on the
that
ends
is
here.
Unusual.
So it was just one of those things where, you know, it was a one of a kind.
Let's see. Let me just,
I don't know, you know, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, just hold it. Oh, yeah, that's perfect. Just hold it.
But I've never been much for, you know, the strange things that people will tend to do scrimshaw on,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So you've done mostly the traditional.
I find that it's traditional art form, right. And my feeling is, although, you know, some people have taken it out there, I don't know, this might sound corny, but I have a real reverence for the material I work with. It's a really precious, rare commodity, and I really feel the urge and the need to do something with the material that's going to, I don't know, treat it right.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's the way to say mm-hmm. it. But the other thing is, in style, now this is a basket that I did for my mother back when I first started.
You're doing the tops and someone...
That's right, I did the tops. I want to be real clear about that. That was Martha Lawrence's work there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is Michael Caine, who's a very good basket maker on the island.
Gee, that's spectacular.
But you see, this work is really, it's very quite traditional. This was done in the early 70s, so it really, it almost is indicative of what I was doing. The borders around the outside here are right out of the whaleman's lexicon.
It's a traditional scene.
It really is.
Yeah.
And this was my mother's purse, a 10-inch basket that Michael made for her. And then I had done the inside for her also. But,
could you just
sure. And it's funny because, again, I was sort of searching for my own style, and it took me a long time to find a happy medium, to find a place where the antique pieces that I revered and held in such high esteem melded with what I was doing as an artist, and I found a spot that worked for me.
So it's sort of taking the old traditional scenes and using your own traditional style to do it. To do the craft?
Yeah, I do work from studies, when you say traditional scenes. Now, this particular book was done by Albert Cook Church, and he was the scion, the descendant of a very, very wealthy whaling family.
Mm-hmm.
And these photographs are some of the best photographs. They were taken in the 20s, in the twilight of American whaling.
The end of whaling.
Right at the end. I mean, you know, there's the last American whale ship in this, wrecked on the rocks.
They're doing a project in New Bedford of descendants of whalers and collecting their oral histories.
I read that. In fact, Gonzalez's wife just passed away. She was 102 or 100. Leonora Gonzalez, my dad on the Cape, had cut
mm-hmm.
the obituary out. He died in 34.
I can give you the name of the folklorist.
Oh, doing great!
That project.
Terrific!
And then you can
because those people are, you know, I've actually contacted descendants of whaling masters and captains.
There's a video that they did on the oral history of the descendants of whales. Yeah.
Oh, this is neat.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is one study that I did right here, and this really gives you an idea of what I'm doing. It's a money clip that I've made in sterling silver. I do all my own metal work. That's one of the nice things about going to Mass Art. I really got the opportunity to work with a lot of different materials.
Mm-hmm.
And a very traditional, this is the Wanderer, which was the last surviving American whale ship. And I had a client that came in and asked me to do something really special. He had donated a piece of the Wanderer to Kendall.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's beautiful.
So that's my rendition of Church's image. So I do use, you know, you asked me about where I get ideas, and a lot of them are, I document and research things, like find out what the harbor looked like in the 1840s from going to the museum and looking mm-hmm. things over, paintings. And then a lot of sketches, a lot of, you know, drawing.
Mm-hmm.
This is a piece of fossilized ivory from Alaska. Now,
did someone bring you the ivory, or do you get the ivory?
Actually, I work directly with the Inuit and the Yupik people up there,
mm-hmm.
and they send me material. And then what
have
I do is...
Have you ever been up there?
I never have. I've talked to them on the phone. We've had a handshake, a long-distance handshake relationship for about 15 years. They send me a box of stuff. They know what I'm looking for. And it's getting harder and harder to find this material. This is what they call wash ivory or beach ivory. And it's up to 20,000 years old.
Wow.
It's beautiful material. It cuts a very fine line. And that's my sperm whale there. again, lots of... Now, this is a sort of a variation. There's a lot of stippling work there, which you generally wouldn't have seen on, you know, 19th century scrimshaw. So it's a little bit more... I don't think
what
the
is
flash
the
went off there.
And
the stippling is all the dots.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah. So that's time-consuming because everything has to be done with a scribe. It's all just simple dot work that's done that way. And then I use my knife to do my cross hatching, which is lines in all
How
different directions.
How long would it
directions.
Take you to do a piece like this?
Like that? Oh, God. Somewhere probably around 20, 25 hours. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll make a mount for it, so it'll have like a probably a nice rosewood or mahogany mount, and the piece will be pegged or cradled so that it'll set in. This, again, is some of the fossilized material here that I work with also. And I mill my own ivory with John Mitchell's old bandsaw and cut and polish each piece by hand. The nice thing about this ivory is you never know what it's going to look like until you open it up. I mean, look at the bark on that. And you open it up, and then beautiful, creamy material, you know? It's just... It's like an adventure, you know, when you're working on things like that.
Well, you know, it's so different. You just never know.
Oh, I can get some better light there, too, if you want. This is a piece that I'm really interested in the island itself. The topography of the island. This is something
that... That's fabulous.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
You're really incredible.
Well, this is a 19th
really
century
nice.
Tooth.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I've opened up the back and I'm going to be signing it. These are the chop marks where it was actually spaded out of the whale's jaw. And you see, this is a true 19th century piece because this is the only part that would have been exposed through the gum line.
Uh-huh.
So that what the whalemen did is they came in like this in order to pry it out. And I've left these in. Although what I've done is, this is what I call a cameo cut, where I actually take the whale tooth and mill it and cut it, but leave the bark, this beautiful exterior on the outside of the piece to show the age, because it really does
nice
have a...
Nice piece.
It sure
it's
is,
a very
it?
Nice piece. It's just the piece itself.
Yeah, it's very, you know... And I'll look at a tooth, like, I'll leave a tooth like that on my bench for a couple of months sometimes, thinking, what am I going to do on this particular scene? And then I'll be... Sometime it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, I'll say, oh, geez, I got a great idea for that big bull sperm whale tooth that...
Wow, look at that.
...fits right in your hand.
Okay, help me pick it up.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah. That probably came from a...
How old do you think this is?
That, again, came from the same collection that I bought. I'm going to guess Golden Age of Whaling, 1850s. Yeah, and it's a beauty.
That
I mean, what a
really
what
amazing.
What a canvas to be able to work on.
Such a large area to work
yeah,
on when you
yeah.
can
Yeah.
Think of a lot of these scrimshaw pieces, very small,
right,
delicate.
Right. Now that's just, you know, it's a prize. And see, this is where it goes back to, you know, and in the article, you know, we talked about the materials. And when you have a piece of material that's this nice, you really want to stop and think long and hard about what you're doing.
Right.
You know, I mean, to me it's just that they're so rare and so hard to come by and so precious and dear that, you know, you really have to give it a lot of thought. So that's why that's sitting right there. And I polished that whole piece up because it didn't really have the nice bark that this one had. But what I did here was, this is the map of Nantucket as it would have looked during the Age of Whaling. Of course, this Smith's Point ends right about here. Mm-hmm. There's a little island called Esther's Island right here. Mm-hmm. The Indians called Tuckernuck Island a loaf of bread because it resembled the shape of a loaf of English bread. And... it's done topographically in the round, so what you see is places like the Hidden Forest, where my kids like to go, and Quidnet with the pond, and Pocomo out here on the point, and all the Indian villages are here, and then, of course, the ponds, which were an integral part of the sheep industry and things. Excuse me for one minute.
I gotta change my phone anyway.
Do you want to turn that off?
Okay, so you were explaining the map on that piece.
Right, right. Again, it's all cut out, first of all, and then hand sanded by hand so that you see all these little things over here. The spade marks have been left, although they've been sanded and polished. And then all the, for instance, the Hallover, Walwinnet, Koskeda, Kotu, Shimo, Monomoy, all the old Indian areas, the ponds, and this is the way Nantucket would have looked, including these two little islands here that don't exist anymore called the Gravelly Islands.
Like lost by erosion?
Yeah, exactly. All this land here is now up here at Great Point. So the island's sort of shifting and moving around. But this is the way it would have looked about 1840, 1850. And I've done the shoals and things topographically. Altar Rock was a very famous Indian spot. Mm-hmm. And then there was Gibbs Pond right over here, too.
Did you ever hear of the Native American tradition of Skrimshander in the Wampanoag community?
You know, I'm not sure. There's a lot of misinformation having to do with Scrimshaw and romanticism having to do with Scrimshaw. Mm-hmm. That's one thing that Stuart Frank can also tell you about, because we've debunked a lot of this stuff by reading the logs. You know, there were all these grainy stories about, you know, this and that, and they've been kind of passed down as fact. And through real intensive research, you know.
There is a
piece up here that I'm thinking about what's going to happen with this. This is a really terrific piece. It's a fossil walrus full tusk, which is extremely rare. I do work for Mystic Seaport for their annual International Marine Art Show. That's I do, you know, I'd like to enter this piece, but I don't know whether I'll have it finished in time. And it's just such a great piece of
Now, when is that show?
Ivory. That's in June. Mm-hmm. That's in June. And to do a piece like this is probably going to take me close to 3 months. Mm-hmm. So I don't know whether it'll be ready or not. But
And that entries from people?
Internationally. Yeah, all over the world.
What other cultures do this kind of work? I mean, you think of it as a New England kind
of thing. The Norwegians carved. Because they had the factory ships, you know, back in the 30s and 40s. Mm-hmm. But they carved more than scrimshawed. English scrimshaw. There's some very rare examples of French scrimshaw.
How would you define scrimshaw as opposed to carving?
Carving would be more in the round. For instance, the Norwegians tended to carve. They take a whale's tooth and carve like a penguin out of it. You know, you could see the form or a hawk or something like that. Whereas the scrimshaw, to me, is basically the engraved lines incised and then actually pigmented. And that's what I'm doing with all these pieces. But it's really typically an American art form, although the English did some. The English whaling fleet was...
You think of it mostly as New England.
Oh, absolutely.
You know.
Sure, yeah. A lot of the images that I do, too, Eleanor, are images of the island. For instance, I love the lights. This is Sankaty Light.
Mm-hmm.
That's Brant Point Light. And then I do Great Point, which is the most inaccessible of the three lighthouses, just because you need four-wheel drive to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Restoration work. These are two really sweet little 19th century blocks that were made by whalemen. And they were missing the inner shivs, so I had to make and patina and match and carve those out of whale ivory. This is something that
I really love to do. Like a really variety of skills.
Yeah.
Think about it.
I guess matching and carving and color and scale and
the historic influence and thinking about the piece and the how to outlay the design on the piece, and the piece is not, you know, you think about the piece you know, you've got like a couple of shots to do it. It's not like a canvas that you can just say, okay, doesn't work on this page, I'll try another one. What was that piece that's in your hand? What was that used for?
These were rope. These were for taking ropes. Mm-hmm. They were shiv blocks that we used for. These are really nice examples. One is whalebone and one is whale ivory, whale tooth.
Okay.
Versus the bone, the jawbone that I showed you over there. And these would have been used for the rope to coil through.
Yes.
You know, so it wouldn't get buggered up. And the original bronze pegging here. There's also a really nice example. You see, years ago, how this happened was the restoration work that I did with John Mitchell really served me well, but there were all these wonderful artifacts out there, 19th century artifacts that were broken, that I just look at them and I you know, they were magnificent things, but they were diamonds in the rough. They were just, they were damaged. And again, you know, I in the early 80s, I attempted to do some restoration work on them and found it really fulfilling to take something that was in a box, just totally broken up, like a beautiful antique whalebone yarn winder swift, and restore it to its magnificence. You know, it just, to me, that was so fulfilling. Stuart Frank had asked me to do one for Kendall, and interestingly enough, it belonged to, they're in Sharon, which is a really weird place for whaling museum, but it belonged to, it's the only attributable piece of whaleman's art that came from a Sharon native. And Davenport, Silas Davenport Jr. was his name. He was a Civil War veteran, a cobbler after the war, and he did a few pieces of scrimshaw early in his career as a whaleman, and this was a piece that was literally in a box. And Stuart said, you know, I know you've done these. Would you attempt doing this? And it was absolutely magnificent. It's in the main hall when you walk into the whaling area with the attributable scrimshaw. And it was such a, I don't know, it was like, you asked me about religion before, but it was like a religious experience bringing this thing back. It was just like.
When did you do this work?
I did that about 4 years ago for Kendall. And they even featured it in their newsletter in the back. And that's why he's asked me to come up and talk about architectural scrimshaw and restoration techniques and things like that. It's really. It's very fulfilling and rewarding. This is a wonderful example of a 19th century pie crimper. Now, the pie crimpers would have been done in all sorts of material. This happens to be done in whale tooth and walrus tusk ivory.
Wow.
And look at that wheel. I mean, it's just spectacular. But unfortunately,
are these pieces ending up as everyday pieces in homes in the 19th century, or were they just unusual as well to find them?
You know, they said that, Edward Stackpole, I believe, said that just about every New England home, because there were so many people involved in the whaling industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like the gas station industry is today. Everybody gets gas. Everybody pumps gas or has something to do with gas every day. This was the energy source for the 19th century.
Yeah.
So that he estimated that just about every home in New England had a piece of scrimshaw in it, because there were so many thousands of men involved in the industry. This piece had broken, and this arm was missing, and I ended up restoring it, milling a new piece. I'm still working on getting the color just right, but it's almost there, and then it'll be pegged right back through, like so, and it'll be restored and be able to be displayed. I'll peen it over with a coin silver or silver rod and peen over both sides. This is really very rewarding work. It's very not to say that my artwork isn't, because believe me, I like to tell people when I get up in the morning, I'm chomping at the bit to go to work. I don't know how many people can say.
Very fortunate.
You know, I count my blessings, because it's a pleasure to go to work every day. It's not drudgery. It never has. In 30 years, I've never had a day when I went, oh, I gotta go down and work. It's always like, and that sounds strange, because just about everyone I know complains about what they do. Maybe it's that a lot of it is my own philosophy, too. I work best on my own. People have asked me about having, you know, gee, couldn't you get somebody in here to help you do your polishing and the scud work and stuff. And I learned how to do woodwork and metalwork as allied to my artwork because everything had to be the way I wanted it to be. I guess I'm just real particular about all this stuff. And if I make a base for a tooth, I have a picture in my mind as to how the proportion should be and all. There's a few photographs of a few pieces. Again, I don't have all that much work to show you. This was my Mystic entry several years ago. Now, you asked me about where I got ideas from. This was from Marshall Gardner's...
Photograph.
Oh, okay. Do you think that'll work? You tell me about bouncing light or whatever, but... But this was a piece of fossilized ivory that I did for the Mystic show. The Rainbow Fleet was Commodore Austin Strong, the Nantucket Yacht Club, would teach young people to sail. And they got the ideas of painting all the sail, the little cat boats, all different colors. And all stipple work, it's all dot work, which it just took so long.
That must have took a long time.
Right.
Where's that piece now?
It's in a private collection. It was in Mystic, and it was shown at Mystic, and, and it was sold at the show. Again, all my own woodwork, my own presentation bases and things. They're just, this was a piece that I did for President Bush. And I was commissioned by, when they opened up the library.
It's the seal,
Houston.
Yeah. Oh, you did the seal?
It's the presidential seal on one side. And this is the sister ship to the Constitution.
Oh.
It was called the President.
Oh.
And it was a perfect, I was given the tooth. It was bigger than this tooth here. I was given the tooth by the collector who was giving it to the president on the occasion of the opening of the library. Mm-hmm. I got a wonderful letter back. Excuse me for one minute.
I'm going to see if I can make That's great.
Well, this particular dealer knew the president because he lived very closely to him in Walker's Point up there in Maine. So he gave me the tooth, and I had an idea of what I wanted to do, and I made the presentation base out of Macassar ebony, and it says, tooth from a sperm whale captured during a 19th century whaling voyage. And this is interesting because this image, you asked me about where I get ideas from. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there are no photographs of the president. She was scuttled, I think, sometime in the 1820s. But there was a French engraver that did this wonderful, wonderful image of, and it said, American warship Le Président. I worked from that. The tooth was massive, and I thought that it was a fitting piece. And then it was presented to the president at the opening of the Houston Library in, I think, 97. Well, that's when he parachuted out of the plane and did all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I got a wonderful letter back from him. Yeah. You know,
nice.
Saying how much he enjoyed the piece and that he wasn't going to give it to the library, that he was going to keep it on his desk for a while to enjoy.
Oh, how nice.
So that was a thrill.
That's cool.
That was really
neat,
you know. And here's a globe. Now, you see that globe there. These are 19th century billiard balls. And what I do with these when I can find them.
Oh, they made out of ivory?
Ivory, right. They're 19th century billiard balls. And a little bit of the history behind this. The Brunswick Pool Table Company, which still makes pool tables, was making ivory billiard balls. But ivory doesn't stay true. It tends to rack and turn. And so the pool players, you know, if they were in the desert southwest, the ivory would move, and they could never shoot the pool cue and have it, the ball, and have it go totally straight. So we offered $10,000 to the first person that could come up with a composition ball. And that was one of the earliest forms of plastic.
Mm.
It was made out of cellulose and pine pitch resin and things like that. So they stopped making the ivory balls.
Mm.
And they're quite rare and hard to come by. This has got a beautiful patina on it.
Yeah.
But I've done the world topographically with the Great Lakes.
Is this the same as this?
It's very similar. Yeah, yeah. I do all the turnings on the lathe. I cut the arc out of whalebone, and then I turn and do all my mountings. But there's, I even put Hawaii. And then what I also do, and I haven't done this yet on this particular piece, is the whalemen would stop here in what they call the Western Islands, which mm-hmm. are the Azores. Mm-hmm. And they'd pick up provisions, so I'll do a little, you can see it here, a little whale ship uh-huh. picking up provisions.
The Azores is very big in the trade.
We've been to the yeah. Azores. My yeah. wife and I went. My wife says the only place I take her on vacation is to ex-whaling port. We've been to Lahaina and Hawaii so that I could go in the whaleman's yeah. jail and yeah. actually sit where the whalemen's, you know, yeah. after they got too drunk and the missionaries threw them in jail.
The tank.
Right, yeah. right. So I was in old town Lahaina, and I took her to the Azores. In fact, we went there for our honeymoon, and I did a lot of research and yeah. Actually met a man who still made.
Does she have an interest in this?
Yeah, she's actually. She's kind of grown, you know, with it because it's such a part of me.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be like if I didn't have a right arm. She wouldn't miss it,
yeah.
you know, but it is my right arm, so to speak, so, you know.
You're so fortunate in that you found something that you love so much. And
oh, yeah.
Just so,
yeah.
Such a beautiful thing to do.
It's a blessing. It's hard work. I'm really, I'm very focused.
You don't work with any magnification at all?
I wear my glasses now.
That's it?
Well,
yeah.
I had an ophthalmologist yeah. client of mine that came uh-huh. in every year to see me in the shop. And he'd say, still no glasses? And I'd say, you know, I'm never going to need glasses. Well, man, I hit 40. Bam.
Right.
It's all over. He came and started laughing because he tried to explain to me, you know, oh, you're going to need glasses. You're going to need glasses when you turn 40. And so, yeah, I do. Occasionally, I use some magnification. I tend to find it really distracting, though, because what ends up happening is your depth of field changes if you look up or something
mm-hmm.
like that, and then you got to kind of get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the work that you see here, the other thing about my work is if you run your finger over the top of it, everything is actually engraved. There's no painting.
Yeah.
You see, that's the key right
there.
How do
you get the color?
I use oil paints, and I'll mix my paints and pigments, and I'll blot. So, for instance, like what I'm doing right now is I'm working on sepias, things like my striped bass and things
mm-hmm.
like that in this piece.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll actually, these paper plates work great because you
mm-hmm.
can get the oil out. You end up with a real concentrated pigment, and then you wipe and work in and away. So the key is to work from dark to light, and also to be very careful when you're wiping so that you don't wipe into
mm-hmm.
you know, the darker areas, so, but,
I mean, besides skill, you also need a lot of patience, I would think.
You know what's funny? I always find the people that ask me that question, and you might be an exception to the rule, are people who have no patience. I don't see it that way, but maybe that's just because
yeah.
it's what I do.
Yeah. Well, I have a lot of patience.
Okay,
all right. And
see,
some
I mean,
people don't understand it. It's a certain
yeah.
type of way of thinking and settling in.
Yeah.
And time just goes by.
It does.
And you're just,
it does.
You know, you're just working. I have that with my writing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just
yeah.
get into a certain frame of mind, and you just, I don't know, you're in another world.
Oh, yeah.
Just,
yeah.
They are writing.
And I do books on tape while I'm working.
Uh-huh.
I always have these books on tape. I don't know which one this one is. But it's either history or fiction
yeah.
or. And they're usually 18 hours long, so my wife will say, it's time for dinner. And between the carving and trying to figure out what's going to happen in the last chapter of the book that I'm listening to.
God, you must be well-read or,
you know,
well-listened to
it,
or whatever the word
is. I love it. I learn yeah. so much. It's like another education because
yeah.
what I'm doing with my hands and my eyes and my brain, I like stimulation, you know? So the fact that I'm able to... I mean, I got into this whole Civil War thing. I went down to the Athenaeum at our library.
Yes.
And they had a whole rack on Civil War stuff. And I've always been, I'm a history nut anyway.
Yeah.
So I got to the point where I was like, okay, I want to learn everything there is to know about the Civil War. There isn't anyone alive to tell me about it, but So I went through the whole series of things while I was carving, and I've gone beyond the music thing. It's just like, I need to keep my brain occupied and my hands occupied. Mm-hmm. See.
Are you in touch with other scrimshanders? I mean, do you email and talk and?
Yeah. Well, the group in Mystic, there's just a few of us left. You know, from that article.
Yeah.
My old friend Michael and I are still in touch. We're still in touch. A lot of times we give one another tips on, hey, I've got a line on a couple of really, really nice old antique teeth, and do you want to go in on them with me? That kind of business, you know, this or that, or trading, and, you know, I've got this, do you need this?
You see a lot of stuff that passes on as scrimshaw, but it's not the real thing.
There's all sorts of junk out there. There's a lot of plastic polymers. You know, you go on these eBays and this thing like and all this stuff. And it's unfortunate because, you know, when people, if people come to reputable artisans, craftspeople, they can buy really good things. And I see them on these internet eBay things, and they're buying plastic. And they don't realize that it's just blown in an injection mold and then pigmented. You know, and it's made out of petroleum products. Mm-hmm. See, the other thing about this stuff is that stop and think of where this tooth was. It might have been down.
That's 5, what I was thinking about. I was holding that.
Yeah. It might have tangled with a giant squid.
And it got caught.
You know, I mean, it might have been in the Indian Ocean one season. This is stuff that's just, it's beyond, you know.
Yeah.
A piece of plastic is dead. You know, one time for an exhibit, they asked me, and South Street Seaport had asked me to do a piece, but they couldn't.
Oh, yeah.
But they couldn't import a real whale's tooth across state lines. So they gave me a piece of Artec plastic polymer material to work with, and they said, would you show us how the pinprick method was done and what the whaleman would do? They'd take a Godey's Ladies book print or something, and they'd pinprick through and then connect the dots. Now, they weren't all artists. Some of them were. Some of them were real folk artists, and some of them, that's how they did their work. So I did that. I took I made a copy of print, and then I did part of it, and then you could lift it up and look at the image. But it was the one and only time I ever worked on the polymer, and the polymer material was so dead and so lifeless that there was no translucence, there was no bright color shooting up through it. It was just a piece of petroleum resin, which is fine for a doorknob or something.
Right. But not for a piece of artwork. Yeah.
You know, people ask me, they say, you know, when you get to that, what are you going to do when you run out of teeth? I said, hopefully I won't, but if I ever do, there's wood carving. But I'm trying to position myself so that I always have material.
Something to do,
you know?
Yeah.
It's always some replacement.
Side 2, interview with Charlie Mangus by Eleanor Wax, April 26, 2000.
Pieces of this quality was just, I mean.
Now, how do you find them? People just know you and they.
No, this particular piece came to me from the Inuits up there in Alaska.
Yeah.
This was a piece that I did for JFK Jr. It was commissioned. Thank you. problem with this piece is a collector asked me, he said, would you do this particular scene? And it was an image that was recreated from a British, these British warships. Well, Britannia rules the waves. I mean,
yeah.
That was the reason why. Look at these things. They're like 16th century aircraft carriers, you know?
Incredible.
Layers and layers of gunships. And so it was a foreshortened view. I had a ball doing this. There's guys up here, you know, unfurling the sails and doing
detail.
Rigging. There's guys crawling up the rat lines. And,
so what is the name of the ship?
Oh, boy. You know, I do, and it's right out of my head right now. I have it all written down upstairs. And all the gallery work that was done here. This was such a great... I enjoyed doing this piece. Now, remember I told you earlier that there's things I won't do? People say, you know, I want you to do my fill in the blank.
In front of my house.
Yeah, you know.
My dog.
Right. But
my dog's fat.
But this was like, when he showed me what he wanted to have done, I said, oh, this is a challenge. And there's dolls here, there's small little feeder vessels.
So you actually take your scenes from historical stuff, and then, but you it's traditional to do ships on whale bones. So I'm just getting a grasp of how this all fits into the how you change your tradition or enable the tradition or shape the tradition and then bring your own skill into it.
Right. That's something that, you know, I don't know. I think I've gotten it down after all these years. It's sort of instinctive. It's in my brain. This was an image of Sankaty Light, but it's old Sankaty with the old lighthouse keepers.
Yeah.
You know,
which is different from the smaller.
Well, you see, the houses have changed. Now there's no house there because it was taken down by the Coast Guard. Uh-huh. It was going to dump it onto the bluff. Uh-huh. But this is what it looked like circa 1870. I did some research. There's the lighthouse keeper, his wife in Victorian garb, and their little daughter, which is hard to see in the image, and she's playing with a parasol. This is actually a photograph that was taken at the keeper's home. Great sort of snapshot history. And the gentleman that commissioned me to do this piece lives very close to the light and wanted an image. And I said, look, I really want to do something with reflects the history behind the light, and I turned the base in Brazilian rosewood that I had recycled. It's not available anymore, and I had actually got a point of view. The challenge is ongoing, and it's trying to keep a traditional. Traditional craft within the parameters of what I feel are, I don't know how to say this, good taste, or within the, but not just good taste, within where it should be. I mean, you know, little pigeons and little things like that don't belong in my scrim shop. But,
Have there been customers?
Yeah, you know, they've respected, I think that they've understood for the most part, and sometimes I can modify and talk to them about something else. Now, for instance, that Sankaty Light piece, it would be really interesting to make a view of what this place looked like, 125 years before we acquired it, and so that you can look at it and see what it was like, and I just this is whalebone on whalebone. I tend to work with a lot of whalebone. I really like the material a lot. It's very rare, very hard to come by. The embargo of 72 has precluded any new materials.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about how that actually works.
It does. I was fortunate enough to be able to purchase material years ago. I still have some of it. I'm actively searching. Into an estate of a whale. it's funny because you take a 19th century craft and the tools of the 21st century, being able to use both, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But all the work that I do, it's funny because people have said to me, oh, you can use this whole sense of digital thing. And that doesn't interest me because these are my tools. These are the things that I use, my handmade scribe that fits in my hand just perfectly. I made it for myself on my lathe. It's knurled so that it keys in and fits in right here on this giant fat callus. and that works. That's my cushion. That works for me. And then my knives.
So really the art of doing the work has it, the way that you practice the art, has it changed?
No. The process is, I'll tell you where it's changed. In the 19th century, the ship's carpenter, who did a lot of the turning on the lathe, was a treadle lathe, but was a hand lathe. So he had to have the cabin boy or someone that could finagle into doing this for him while he was cutting away at the piece of whalebone or whatever. Well, mine's a lathe. That's the difference. Basically the same things that the ship's carpenter would use in the 19th century. I don't use a laser tool or anything like that.
Do you hunt around for old tools?
Oh, yeah. I make a lot of tools.
Uh-huh.
That's the other thing. There's tools that I can't buy, that I've made or modified. That was carelessness. I was working on this thing. I had this idea about what I was going to do. And I drove myself down the hospital and pulled the doctor up and I was working on this stitching. So, but you get, now this is